the ark brought to Jerusalem. David again brought together out of Israel chosen men, 30,000 in all. He and all his men set out from Baala of Judah to bring up from there the ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord Almighty, who is enthroned between the cherubim that are on the ark. They set the ark of God on a new cart and brought it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. Uzzah and Ahio, sons of Abinadab, were guiding the new cart with the ark of God on it, and Ahio was walking in front of it. David and the whole house of Israel were celebrating with all their might before the Lord, with songs and with harps, lyres, tambourines, citrons and cymbals. When they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah reached out and took hold of the ark of God, because the oxen stumbled. The Lord's anger burned against Uzzah because of his irreverent act. Therefore God struck him down, and he died there beside the ark of God. Then David was angry because the Lord's wrath had broken out against Uzzah. And to this day, that place is called Perez Uzzah. David was afraid of the Lord that day and said, "How can the ark of the Lord ever come to me?" He was not willing to take the ark of the Lord to be with him in the city of David. Instead, he took it aside to the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite. The ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, for 3 months. And the Lord blessed him and his entire household. Now King David was told, "The Lord has blessed the household of Obed-Edom and everything he has because of the ark of God." So David went down and brought up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with rejoicing. When those who were carrying the ark of the Lord had taken 6 steps, he sacrificed a bull and a fattened calf. David, wearing a linen ephod, danced before the Lord with all his might, while he and the entire house of Israel brought up the ark of the Lord with shouts and the sound of trumpets. As the ark of the Lord was entering the city of David, Michal, daughter of Saul, watched from a window. And when she saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, she despised him in her heart. They brought the ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent that David had pitched for it. And David sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings before the Lord. After he had finished sacrificing the burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord Almighty. Then he gave a loaf of bread, a cake of dates, and a cake of raisins to each person in the whole crowd of Israelites, both men and women, and all the people went to their homes. When David returned home to bless his household, Michal, daughter of Saul, came out to meet him and said, "How the king of Israel has distinguished himself today, disrobing in the sight of the slave girls of his servants as any vulgar fellow would." David said to Michal, "It was before the Lord who chose me rather than your father or anyone from his house when he appointed me ruler over the Lord's people, Israel. I will celebrate before the Lord. I will become even more undignified than this, and I will be humiliated in my own eyes. But by these slave girls you spoke of, I will be held in honor. And Michal, daughter of Saul, had no children to that day of her death.
The baptism of Jesus. When all the people were being baptized, Jesus was baptized too. And as he was praying, heaven was opened, and the Holy Spirit descended on him in bodily form like a dove. And a voice came from heaven, "You are my Son, whom I love. With you I am well pleased." Now Jesus himself was about 30 years old when he began his ministry.
In Christmas 1972, longish time ago, Sarah and I found ourselves near the summit of a very tall mountain. We were about 8,000 feet above sea level in the Ethiopian highlands. The central part of Ethiopia is all mountains, and that's where the Christian part of Ethiopia is, the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. And we were staying at a monastery called Adwa, about, as I say, near the summit of the mountain, but just below it. And we had as our accommodation a dry stone hut with the wind whistling through the gaps in the stonework. No furniture. We had to sleep on the packed mud. And some blankets made from sort of the wire wool of the local sheep. The monks weren't being inhospitable. They were simply giving us the accommodation that they themselves had. That's all they have. And we were there for Christmas. Well, Christmas arrived, and nothing much happened. There was an extra Holy Communion service. Normally they only had communion on Sundays, or maybe Saturdays. And then they had nothing but in the week, or just communal prayers, but they had an extra communion for Christmas. But that was all. But then, in the days following, lots of families came from the valleys below, where there was cultivation, and they pitched tents made of sheepskin. And so gradually the whole area around the monastery became a kind of tent city, as if it was some kind of pop festival. And there all these people were, being just there. And they just were there. And then the days went on, and on the 12th day after Christmas, there was lots of bustle. There were monks going in and out of the church, in and out of the kitchen, sort of doing lots of things. We weren't quite clear what they were doing, but clearly there was an atmosphere of action and excitement. And then, towards the end of the day, as the sun dropped behind the mountains in the west, they all gathered round the church. The monks and the abbot disappeared into the church, and the people who had come from the valleys were assembled round it. And then, as the last rays of sunshine dipped below the mountains, the monks all came out of the church, dressed in pure white. And then came the abbot, dressed in very colourful costume, with a vast great mitre on his head. And finally came the cabot. And the cabot symbolised the Ark of the Covenant that we've just been hearing about. A big box, a covenant box, as the Good News version puts it. And inside the box was two heavy stone tablets, and they represented the tablets on which the Lord had written the Ten Commandments. And in an Ethiopian church, it's the cabot, the box plus the stones, that makes the church holy and sacred. So emerging from the church after the abbot had come out were some hefty monks, really big monks, and they were carrying the ark with the stone tablets in it. So they came out, and as they emerged, a great cry went up, a great cry of excitement. And for the rest of the night, about 12 hours, they danced. Not everybody danced all the time. They sort of flaked out from time to time and had a little nap. But there was dancing for the whole of that 12 hours in conscious imitation of David dancing before the Ark of the Covenant that we've just been hearing about. It was that passage which inspired them. and we dance too, it wasn't leaping about as the David seems to have done. It was a kind of slow rhythmic dance like this. So even if you had slightly dodgy knees, you could still join in. I mean, we were young, so we had knees that worked. But it was, as I say, a night of dancing. When the abbot flaked out, she took off this enormous hat and pushed it on the ground, so it stood about that high. Anyway, when the first light began to appear in the eastern sky, people formed a procession outside the church. The lay people did, and then the monks, and then there was... Well, in front was the cabot, the bishop, then the monks, then all of us lay people. And as a signal, when we could actually see the rays of the sun, with a signal with the abbot, we began to walk. And we walked down the mountain to an icy blue lake, sort of several hundred feet below. We rhythmically walked, plonk, 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 down to this lake. We didn't know what was going on. We assumed when we got to the lake we'd gather around and have some sort of act of worship. But we got to the lake and they went straight in and started splashing about and splashing each other as if they were little children. And we went in too. Oh, my goodness, it was cold. but it was great joy. And this went on for several minutes. We all got soaking. But the cabot was held aloft. And then, again as a signal from the abbot, we all processed back up the mountain. And then the abbot and the monks went into the church, and the people all sat down nearabouts. And from the monastery kitchen, vast plates of mountain mutton appeared, a sort of mutton stew. And this was only one of two occasions in the year, the other being Easter, when the monks were allowed to eat meat. For the rest of the time, they lived on, and probably still do live on, dry beans and bread. It's hard going. But here they could have meat. So they tucked in with great relish. So it was a great celebratory thing. And then when they'd all filled up with meat, they also drank this absolutely disgusting beer that they make in Highland Ethiopia. So they drank that in large quantities. And by about midday, they were all flat out. The combination of no sleep plus lots of beer. So you had a sort of, as if a Napalm bomb had dropped. Everybody was completely comatose. Except us, because we didn't like the beer. So we were sort of the only conscious ones there. So that was that. Now we gathered that the festival they were celebrating is what's called in this country Epiphany. Their word is Timkut. And Timkut means revelation. So that's what they were celebrating. We gathered that. And we assumed that the mitre that the abbot was wearing was not a bishop's mitre, it was that he was representing the wise men. And actually that's historically accurate. It's probable that the wise men in the Bible were Mithraic priests from Persia, and the headdress of a Mithraic priest in those days was a mitre. So bishop's mitres that we have in the West are in fact pagan headdress. Not sure many bishops realise this. And so he was representing a wise man, and the water of the lake that we splashed about in, we inferred, again correctly, that we were celebrating the baptism of Christ, which is part of what Epiphany traditionally celebrates. So we were kind of thinking about that and getting cold with it. So we got all that. Then the following day, we were allowed to interview the abbot. He'd taken off his finery, was just in a kind of white tunic, really, and a black hat. Very slender. All the monks are slender because you don't get fat on beans and bread. But sort of a radiant complexion, again, as lots of the monks did. And he was very gracious. We sat down and he sat down. And the first question we asked him was, why do you make so little of Christmas and so much of Timkut, of Epiphany? And the answer he gave was roughly this. That actually they're not two separate festivals, they're the two sides of one festival. And what happened on Christmas night was a purely private matter, private to the Jewish people. Mary and Joseph were Jews, the shepherds who came down from the hills, they too were Jewish. And so we celebrate that bit of the festival, the Christmas bit, in a private, quiet sort of way, because it was a private and quiet thing that happened in the stable. But then, Timkut, Epiphany, there we're celebrating Christ becoming public, the Gentiles coming to know Christ. The wise men were the first Gentiles to see Christ and God brought them to Bethlehem to see him. And then the baptism of Christ, when God said, "This is my Son, in whom I am truly pleased," that was a public event, declaring to the world that here was God's Son. And so we celebrate Timcat, not in a private, quiet way, but in a noisy way, in a public way, because it's a public thing. And these are two sides of one festival. Yeah, interesting. Then he said something that was amazing. I think it was amazing anyway. He said, there's another thing we celebrate in Christmas and Epiphany, and it's this, that when Jesus was born, he was born into a world of many gods. Most people, everybody, believed there were lots of gods. Even the early Jewish people, Hebrew people, were polytheist in that sense. They believed in Yahweh as their God, but they recognized the existence of other gods. It was simply that Yahweh was superior in strength and in justice. But when Jesus came into the world, Jesus declared that all those other gods are fantasies. They simply don't exist. So Jesus brought monotheism, the belief in one God, into the world. And that's part of what we celebrate at Epiphany. In the baptism of Christ, "This is my Son, in whom I am well pleased," God was declaring, "I am the only God. Those other gods don't exist. I am the one and only God." And so we celebrate that. Now, after that, the conversation moved on to other topics and was great. Now, I'd largely forgotten about that conversation. It's almost 50 years ago? Yeah, 50 years ago. The decades go by so quickly. Until a few weeks ago when I was preparing for Christmas, and this recollection of this conversation popped back into my head. And I began to think about it. And it's actually true. Prior to Christ, nobody preached full-blown monotheism. There was always more than one God. Some good gods, some bad gods, but more than one. Jesus uniquely preached the one God. There is only one God. The others imaginary. Jesus was the first person to preach that. But here's the extraordinary thing. That part of his mission has been a most stunning success. Far more successful than we properly realize. Let's just think about that. He was born in the Roman Empire. The Romans had lots of gods, including emperors like Caligula were gods. Masses of them. And the whole empire was based on this idea of lots of gods. By about the year 300, all those gods were disappearing. They were sort of, as it were, fading like a Cheshire cat. And the whole Roman Empire was becoming monotheist. Now just think of that achievement. The attitude to the universe was transformed in those 300 years. Then going a bit further forward, when Muhammad became religious, as it were, he was influenced strongly by Christians that taught him. And he thought his teaching was Christian. And we know that from a rather extraordinary event in Muhammad's life. When he started preaching monotheism in Arabia and was persecuted by the sort of Mecca establishment, and he and his followers crossed the Red Sea to Ethiopia, because they knew the king of Ethiopia was a Christian, so they were one with him. So Muhammad believed he was a Christian. But he wasn't, in fact, in lots of ways, and that's another story. He got things wonky. But on the one point about monotheism, Muhammad was right. And through that, monotheism spread across the Middle East. And that, as I say, was through Christianity. Now, I'm going to simplify the story, but leap ahead to the 19th century. Hinduism in India went through a reformation. And the reformation was this. They had believed in many gods, but under the direct influence of Christianity, the leading Hindu teachers of the 19th century began to preach one God, and that these statues and whatnot were simply reflections, possibly, of some aspect of the one God. Now, today, go further east, East Asia, Christianity, including monotheism, is spreading like wildfire in places like China, Singapore, Malaysia, and so on. The mission of bringing one God, and all the other gods are imaginary, is proceeding, and it's now proceeding in East Asia. And now come back home. Now, of course, in the West, organised religion is in decline and ignorance of Christianity, of Christ, is terrible. But on one matter, the Christian mission remains successful. And it's this. All those people out there that don't come to church, the great majority of them believe in one God. They're not polytheists. They don't believe in lots of gods. They believe in one God. They may use other words. They may talk about fate or destiny or the higher power, as Alcoholics Anonymous do. But it's one God to which they are referring. So whereas 2,000 years ago, the default position was there were lots of gods, through Christianity, and directly through Christianity, the default position across the world is there is one great God. One God, and all the other ones are imaginary. Now, what an extraordinary achievement. People like me sometimes think, things are not going well with Christianity. But actually, the mission of Christianity so far has been a stunning success. The foundations are laid. People believe in one God. We now have got to convince more and more people that Jesus is the son of that one God. But we've actually established the first principle that there is one God. And the one that established that, that came into a polytheistic world, was that babe lying in a manger. We should be astonished. I'm astonished when I think about it. Now, at the end of our interview, we got up to go, thinking it was time to go, and the abbot beckoned us to sit down, and he said to us, you remember John the Baptist performed the baptism, and he lived on locusts and wild honey. And the abbot then beckoned to a junior monk, and they brought this bowl of roast locust and wild honey. We had to eat it. And I'm here to tell you, roast locust and wild honey is delicious. Let's sing another hymn.